By the way, if you guys are following, I did the slides on ESV because I believe John has been using ESV. So if you guys are trying to read NIV, try and follow ESV if you guys have it available. But yeah, today's passage is Song of Songs, chapter 3, verse 6 to chapter 5, verse 16. What is that coming up from the wilderness? Like columns of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all the fragrant powders of a merchant. Behold, it is the letter of Solomon. Around it are 60 mighty men, some of the mighty men of Israel, all of them wearing swords and expert in war, each with his sword at his thigh against terror by night. King Solomon made himself a carriage from the wood of Lebanon. He made its posts of silver, its back of gold, its seat of purple. Its interior was inlaid with love by the daughters of Jerusalem. Go out, all you daughters of Zion, and look upon King Solomon, with the crown with which his mother crowned him, on the day of his wedding, on the day of the gladness of his heart. Behold, you are beautiful, my love. Behold, you are beautiful. Your eyes are doves behind your veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats leaping down the slopes of Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of shorn ewes that have come up from the washing, all of which bear twins, and not one among them has lost its young. Your lips are like a scarlet thread, and your mouth is lovely. Your cheeks are like halves of a pomegranate behind your veil. Your neck is like the Tower of David, built in rows of stone. On it hang 1,000 shields, all of them shields of warriors. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle that graze among the lilies. Until the day breathes and the shadows flee, I will go away to the mountain of myrrh and the hill of frankincense. You are altogether beautiful, my love. There is no flaw in you. Come with me from Lebanon, my bride. Come with me from Lebanon. Depart from the peak of Amana, from the peak of Senir and Hermon, from the dens of lions, from the mountains of leopards. You have captivated my heart, my sister, my bride. You have captivated my heart with one glance of your eyes, with one jewel of your necklace. How beautiful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much better is your love than wine, and the fragrance of your oils than any spice. Your lips drip nectar, my bride. Honey and milk are under your tongue. The fragrance of your garments is like the fragrance of Lebanon. A garden locked is my sister, my bride, a spring locked, a fountain sealed. Your shoots are an orchard of pomegranates with all choicest fruits, henna with nard, nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with all trees of frankincense, myrrhs and aloes, with all choice spices, a garden fountain, a well of living water and flowing streams from Lebanon. Awake, O north wind, and come, O south wind, blow upon my garden, let its spices flow. Let my beloved come to his garden and eat its choicest fruits. I came to my garden, my sister, my bride. I gathered my myrrh with my spice. I ate my honeycomb with my honey. I drank my wine with my milk. Eat, friends, drink, and be drunk with love. I slept, but my heart was awake. A sound. My beloved is knocking. Open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one. For my head is wet with dew, my locks with the drops of the night. I had put off my garment. How could I put it on? I had bathed my feet. How could I soil them? My beloved put his hand to the latch, and my heart was filled within me. I arose to open to my beloved, and my hands dripped with myrrh, my fingers with liquid myrrh on the handles of the bolt. I opened to my beloved, but my beloved had turned and gone. My soul failed me when he spoke. I sought him, but found him not. I called him, but he gave no answer. The watchmen found me as they went about in the city. They beat me, they bruised me, they took away my veil, those watchmen of the walls. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, that you tell him, I am sick with love. What is your beloved more than another beloved, O most beautiful among women? What is your beloved more than another beloved? That you thus adjure us. My beloved is radiant and ruddy, distinguished among 10,000. His head is the finest gold, his locks are wavy, black as a raven. His eyes are like doves beside streams of water, bathed in milk, sitting beside a full pool. His cheeks are like beds of spices, mounds of sweet smelling herbs. His lips are lilies, dripping liquid myrrh. His arms are rods of gold set with jewels. His body is polished ivory, bedecked with sapphires. His legs are alabaster columns set on bases of gold. His appearance is like Lebanon, choice as the cedars. His mouth is most sweet, and he is altogether desirable. This is my beloved, and this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem.
Welcome, everyone, to Act 2 of Song of Songs. I was just down the back and saw all the kids with their eyes glued to the computer screen with no idea what we're going to talk about in here today. But again, just a quick warning, mostly for the people that are listening online afterwards. This sermon and this sermon series, we're talking about kind of MA15 stuff, so just be a bit sensitive about who's listening. Let me pray, and then we'll jump into it. Heavenly Father, thank you for your word in all of the Bible, but especially in Song of Songs, which is opening up topics to us that we normally keep hidden. Please help us to understand them wisely and within the context of what you would have us do and within the context of a wise life. And help us to hear the words of Song of Songs today and be able to change and to become more like your son. Amen. So last week, if you remember, we saw our two lovers, so the lover and the beloved, meet and fall in love. And it was a physical love or even an erotic love that we normally keep behind closed doors. But last week, God opened up those doors and he spoke about that type of love really candidly. And surprisingly, he spoke about it in a positive light. It seemed like he was saying erotic love, the love that we feel a bit uncomfortable with in church anyway, or sexual desire, is actually a good thing, which of course we know because God's created it all, but it was a bit jarring to hear God say it in the words that he said it in. But also it came with a warning. It said, I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or the does of the field, that you not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. We still don't quite know what that warning means just yet, but we know that they're saying to be careful about awakening love. And then this week, we're going to explore a bit more about the consequences and maybe some of the reasons behind this warning. So when we left our lovers last week, they were passionately wrapped up in each other, but there were mountains and there were foxes. And the beloved had to return to these mountains. Even though the lover still sought him, there were these things, big and small, that kept them apart from each other. I suggested that it might have been because he wasn't an Israelite, and so they couldn't be together. So while they were passionately wrapped up with each other, there were these forces, mountains and foxes, pulling them apart. At the start of this passage, we jump forward to a time when it seems like the lover and the beloved have been pulled apart. And the daughters of Jerusalem speak first. They see an eye-catching sight off in the distance, something coming up from the wilderness. In the Bible, the wilderness is normally associated with trial or with lack of life or even desolation. But so far, the Song of Songs has taken place in gardens and in cities, which are places both full of life. So something coming up from the wilderness is a bit worrying. But at the same time, it's also perfumed with myrrh and frankincense. And these scents, the scents of these things in the Song of Songs, have been like the expression, the physical embodiment of sexual desire or sexual activity. So we have something desirable, but something dangerous and ominous coming up from the wilderness. Verse 7, as it nears, they see that it's Solomon in his litter, which is like the bed that kings were carried on when they went about the city. And it was surrounded by his mighty men. And you might remember from the prologue, when we looked at chapter 1, verse 1, that this song is somehow connected to Solomon. It's the Song of Songs, which is of Solomon, meaning maybe for Solomon or of Solomon or to Solomon or in the style of Solomon or regarding Solomon, all of these options. Not really clear which one. but there's something to do with Solomon. And we said there were two things that was really famous or well known about Solomon. The first was his wisdom. He asked God for wisdom, and it was given to him in such great measure that he was wiser than anyone that had ever come before him. And the second was his philandering and his adultery. He'd married 1,000 wives and concubines, and that's maybe more than anyone ever married before him, and maybe more than anyone's ever married since. So in a book of wisdom about love and sex, seeing Solomon the wise and Solomon the philanderer coming up in clouds of myrrh from the wilderness should make us really wary. What is Solomon going to do to our beloved and her beloved? Our lover and her beloved? And what's going to happen to their love now that Solomon's in the picture? In verse 9, this litter or this carriage he rides on the outside is made of the finest materials. It's made out of cedar from Lebanon or wood from Lebanon. It's made out of gold and purple cloth, making it stand out and draw the eyes of all the onlookers. It's the most beautiful of all carriages. But what makes up the inside is the love of the daughters of Jerusalem. The inside has seen so many young women pass through that their love or their sexual desire has inlaid the interior more so than gold or silver. And as much as Solomon can't keep away from young women, the young women can't keep away from him as well. Verse 11, the daughters of Jerusalem say to each other, daughters of Zion, go and look at Solomon. The title daughters of Zion stands out a bit because they aren't normally called that in this book. And it's actually kind of unusual in the Bible altogether. The title daughter of Zion, so singular, is common enough in the Bible, and it mostly refers to Israel. But the phrase daughters, plural, of Zion is only used three other times in the Bible, all three times in Isaiah, and all three times refer to women who have the appearance of beauty or who are proud on the outside, but inside are wicked and unclean and unfaithful. So here to say, daughters of Zion, go look upon Solomon, is an invitation to kind of unleash or to turn up your sexual desire, both on the part of Solomon and on the part of the daughters. But it's only one woman that catches Solomon's eye on this day. So chapter 4, verse 1, he sees the lover and he says, behold, your eyes are beautiful, my love. Behold, your eyes are doves. He has these sweet, enticing words, but they're words that we've actually heard before. They're the exact same words that her beloved said to her in chapter 1, the same words that won her over way back then. And so now we have a second beloved vying for the love of our lover. Solomon starts with the beloved's words, but he goes on with more words and more imagery than the beloved ever did. He admires her flowing hair, her white teeth, her scarlet lips, her rosy cheeks, her long neck, and of course her two breasts. They're all within his view. But he gives her a different offer than the beloved. Have a look at verse 6. When she was with her beloved, when the day began to breathe and the shadows fled, the beloved had to flee to the rocky mountains that divided them because he wasn't an Israelite. But here, Solomon says, when the day breathes and the shadows flee, Solomon's going to go to the mountain of myrrh and of frankincense. And in verse 8, he invites her to come with him away from the mountains of Lebanon. And we've already seen that myrrh and frankincense in the Song of Songs are fragrances that kind of embody sexual desire or sexual activity. So if she goes with Solomon to these mountains, she can have her sexual desires fulfilled and she won't ever have to be separated from her beloved. her desires can be fulfilled in perpetuity. But in verse 9, Solomon can call her my sister because he's a fellow Israelite, something the beloved couldn't ever say. And then Solomon's words become more and more explicit to the lover with images of like wine and with dripping nectar and flowing honey and milk. But in verse 12, she's a locked garden to him. She's closed off from him, maybe because she still loves her beloved. So her choice fruits, her spices, all those kind of images, her garden fountain are kept away from him. But then in verse 16, it all turns around. In her reply to him, she says, "Awake, O north wind, and come, O south wind, and blow upon my garden, and let its spices flow." She opens up all of her fruits to him. She awakens love with another lover, despite her own mournings. And she now calls Solomon, the lover of many women, her beloved. And then chapter 5, verse 1, Solomon describes the fulfilling of their sexual desires as luxury on luxury. He gathers myrrh, and on top of that, he gathers spices as well. He eats honeycomb, and on top of that, he eats honey as well. He drinks wine, and he drinks milk. It's just luxury on top of luxury. And because of that, because that's Solomon's experience, he says to the listener, to anyone who would hear, you should do the same. Eat every luxurious thing. Fulfill your every desire for love. Do it all. And so we have a paradox in the book. The lover tells us not to awaken love until it so desires. But then she says to Solomon, awaken. Awaken, O north wind. Come blow on my garden. And Solomon says, eat and be drunk with love. Fulfill all your sexual desires. So what do? Do we be careful with love or do we revel in love? On a night after this, maybe the very first night after this, or maybe many nights after this, our lover's asleep on her bed, but she hears a knocking and she hears a voice. Open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one. It's not clear who's speaking because both the beloved and Solomon speak to her in this way. I think it makes the most sense that it's the first beloved speaking, because it seems like he comes in the cover of darkness and there's kind of a hint that he's not meant to be there. And if Solomon's actually made her his bride at this point, you'd probably expect Solomon to be in bed with her or to not need to come in the cover of darkness. And so her response in verse 3, I'd put off my garment, how can I put it back on? I'd bathe my feet, how can I soil them again? Isn't about her being a bit too lazy to go and get the door because it's late. It's saying, I've been with another man now. Maybe I've even married him at this point. How can I see my beloved again? But she must go see him. Her love won't let her just lie in bed. Her love won't let her ignore her beloved, her first beloved. And so she gets up and then myrrh drips from her fingers. Her sexual desires awaken again. Or maybe they never left. But when she reaches the door, he's gone. But maybe he was never there. Maybe those were the words of her imagination, what she hoped would happen. Because in verse 2, it says she slept, but it was her heart that was awake. That same word that's the same word that's in the warning not to awaken love. And also her beloved calls her sister. But if we're right and he's a foreigner, he can't call her that. He hasn't called her that before, and he doesn't call her that again. So I think we're hearing the words that she hopes to hear. She wishes her beloved would return, and she wishes that he would call her sister so that they could be together. And there'll be more evidence of that in chapter 8. But for now, I think it makes the most sense that this is the first lover. And these words are the words of her dreams and her hopes. And that's enough for her now to get up and open the door and for her to set off in search of her beloved, like she did earlier. And like in chapter 3, when she sought her missing beloved for the first time, she encounters the watchmen of the city. But this time, they don't just ignore her question, "Where is my beloved?" This time, they beat her and they bruise her and they remove her veil. So it's unclear exactly what's going on, but I think she's now stopped by the watchman instead of just being ignored, because now she's part of Solomon's harem. She can't go and seek her beloved anymore. No matter what her heart wishes, she's awakened love with Solomon, and so she doesn't get the opportunity to awaken it with anyone else. So everything now has fallen apart for her. She's awakened her love with her beloved, but her beloved's gone. She's awakened her love with Solomon, but because of his smooth words, she was taken in, but she still seems unsatisfied. And she's now torn between the two. And there's consequences to her choices. She can't just go off and look for her beloved. There's watchmen, and they beat her, and they remove her veil. So she's awakened love before it desires. What can she do now? Her heart longs for the beloved, but now she's given it to another. So what choice does she have? What's she going to do? In verse 8, she says again, "I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem." But this time it's not a warning to not awaken love. She says, "I adjure you to find my beloved for me." Her choice is to go deeper in. The love she's awakened is so strong, even in this situation where everything around her is collapsing, nothing's working out right. The love she's awakened is so strong that she can't step back. She can only double down and go further in. And she begs the daughters of Jerusalem to go look for her beloved for her, because she can't go. And they ask, "Why? What's so special about this guy that you seek him even now in all this trouble?" And her answer is that he's the embodiment of perfection. His eyes are doves, his cheeks smell sweet, his lips are enticing, his arms are gold, his body's ivory, his legs are unshakable pillars. In her overly perfect description of him, one thing stands out in verse 16, which is the last verse of our passage. She calls him her beloved, which she always does. But she also calls him her friend, which is out of character in this book. The book so far has been just overloaded with sexual overtones. Every phrase seems to have a double meaning for something much more sexual. But this word here, friend, is, I think, just what it sounds like. It's kind of just our first and maybe our only hint that there's more to love than sexual desire. There's friendship as well. It doesn't last long because the story moves on and this idea is not really picked up. But in a book that's dominated by sexual desire, it's kind of refreshing to have this. But at the end of it all, she's separated from her beloved and she can't even seek him herself. And that's the end of our passage today. So what do we do with this train wreck of a passage? One important thing that stands out, I think, is that it's interesting that it's not solely about holiness. When we come to the Bible, we expect it to tell us about what God wants, what his laws are, how to be more holy. But in Song of Songs, there's no mention of God, no mention of the temple or of the Torah or of holiness or of sacrifice. None of that's mentioned at all, except maybe in one verse, but there's a debate about the translation. So while holiness is clearly the call of every Christian, It seems like this book is more concerned about the practical warnings of awakening love, which is kind of the mark of wisdom literature, real world consequences. If you awaken love before it desires, the book says it can lead to heartache, it can lead to loss, it can lead to pain, it can lead to unbearable situations. And not just in the short term. We see with our example of the lover that this kind of love, once awakened, is like an unstoppable force. Her life's in shambles. She's made some bad decisions, but she can't stop them. She has to go on. She has to seek her lover further. She has to double down despite what's going on around her. It's like there's something in the human heart that can't stop once it gets going. Once you awaken love, despite the terrible consequences, it's hard to stop. And instinctively, we kind of know, because we'd say, of course you can't stop. She loves you. Doesn't matter if she gets beaten up. It's honorable to keep going because of love. Doesn't matter if she's married. She's in love with this other guy. Because we kind of know, or we've kind of feel, or we've kind of seen the pull of awakened love in our own lives, maybe to varying degrees. So you can sympathize with what she's doing. You know why she would go through beatings and bruisings to find her beloved. And I think that's the point that it's making. Once you awaken love, it's hard to control. You throw in bad decision after bad decision because it's an unstoppable force. Even though there's no objective sense to making those choices. The lover doesn't actively warn us not to awaken love in this chapter, but her story of awakening love and the consequences come to us as a warning. And it's not the precise point of this passage, but we can draw it out a bit more theologically as well. When the desires of the human heart are switched on, it's hard to stop in general. Jesus has similar words for us where he says, you can't serve two masters. We think it's fine to dabble in greed or in lust or in whatever else we would have as Lord besides Jesus, but the human heart just doesn't work like that. Once awakened, those desires can't really be put away very easily. We can't just switch off the money for the desire for money or for power or for sex or for whatever you choose. Once you switch that on and you make that your God, it's hard to stop. It's almost an uncontrollable force. We can't at the drop of a hat stop that and then serve God. So the message of the lover has some pretty broad implications. And more than just for physical desire and for love. But I think maybe that's the most powerful. Maybe love is the hardest to control. And I think maybe it's the most damaging. So it's a beautiful thing when awakened at the right time, but it's a monster when it's not. Okay, let's pray. Father, thank you for helping us understand our own hearts better today. Help us to be careful with what we awaken, especially with love, because we, to some extent, can't control our own emotions and our own desires. Help us, Lord, to be really careful and thoughtful and wise with how we choose to awaken love. And we pray that we might live really wise lives. And awaken love at the right time. Amen.
All right, John, you're ready for this.
Before we start, I just thought of something that I should say, maybe two things. So one was like in Bible study a couple of weeks ago, someone asked, one of the things I said a couple of weeks ago was that what I hope this sermon series does is start to make us more open to and more willing to talk about these sort of sexual things. And the question was like, what do I mean by that? Do I mean like we just start to compliment each other on our looks or like sexual or something? But like what I meant by that was that I hope that because like these things are really private, right? Like sex, you know, like body parts, fluids, all that sort of stuff. It's like really private, but God is like saying those words to us. So it's awkward for me to say it, but God says it, right? Yep. And so what I mean by, I hope this makes us more comfortable to talk with each other, is not so much in public, but in private with a person that you trust or something. Maybe if you are going through issues like where you have like sexual desire, but you don't have a way to express it.
Yeah.
Maybe you can talk to someone about that, because it's not so weird, because God's already raised the topic. Mm. Or you can talk about to your husband or wife if you're not sexually fulfilled in marriage. Like that would be super awkward, right? But God talks about that already. So that's why I'm hoping the types of conversations it'll open up. Not so much the public ones, but the important ones that happen in private. But you can talk about it in public as well if you want.
If you're open to it, carefully. All right, now let's look up the first question. Why does he call his bride also his sister in chapter 5?
Yeah, it's very sus.
It's very sus.
Because actually in chapter 8 as well, like it adds to that. I'll try and flick it open, but it says that the lover says something like, "Oh, I wish you were my brother, and you would suckle on my mother's breasts," or something like that, like as in you were raised with me side by side on my mother's breast. So it's weird, but I think so. My interpretation of this is that the mother is actually Jerusalem. So it's like the kind of instances of the mother are mostly Jerusalem or Israel. And so it's like, I wish that, well, so Solomon calls her my sister because it's like my fellow Israelite, we can do this. The lover can't say that because he's a foreigner, which is what I think. And then her wish later on that she would kind of, that the beloved were to suckle on, did suckle on. I should find it because I'm probably, it's probably like worse than it sounds really. "If only you were to me like a brother who was nursed at my mother's breasts." So she's saying like, if only you were a fellow Israelite, then all of this, like, it would have been avoided, right? I could have been with you. So he calls her sister. Solomon calls her sister because it's like my fellow Israelite and my bride now. So not as sus as it sounds.
All right. I hope that answers the question. Next one is, why does God allow Solomon to have many wives?
Mm. Yeah, so it's clearly a good question because it's clearly not a thing that God wants. So the intention right from the start, right from Genesis, is one husband, one wife. That's a marriage. And then anything that kind of changes that, so we've seen like multiple marriages, even things like adultery outside of marriage, even divorce to some extent is not desired by God. Why does he allow people to do those things? I guess because people choose, right? Like people just choose to do those things. And there are some consequences to it, because one of the major reasons why Israel falls apart is because Solomon has many wives, and his many wives leads him astray, and then God punishes him for that. So it's he allows it because he allows it, I think, because he lets us choose these bad things with consequences, and through those things we actually learn more about him. Like by going through that, you kind of learn, oh, maybe God's way that's described in Song of Songs is actually a bit better. Maybe having many wives isn't good. Maybe awakening love too early is not good. So I think we learn about God through those things as well. And sorry, I should also say, like, I'm talking about lots of sensitive topics. So if like you've gone through things like maybe in the words of Song of Songs, maybe you've awoken love before it desires, like that's not, like because you've made that one mistake, that's not the end of it. And that's the good thing about God letting us do these things, right? Like it's not the end of it, and there's forgiveness, there's redemption, there's healing, all that sort of stuff as you follow Jesus. So I just want to clarify that too.
Yep. Okay. Next one. Does the veil symbolize something in verse 5?
Oh, yeah. So she gets beaten, she gets her veil taken off, and it's actually not very clear what the veil symbolizes, but what I think it symbolizes in Song of Songs, because the veil's mentioned a few times, and I think what it mentions is, what it symbolizes is kind of like a a veil of like innocence or handling sexual desire as well, because she has it in the beginning and she's like, why should I be as one veiled amongst the shepherds, I think, when I desire you. It's like, I don't want this. Like, I want you. I don't want this veil. And then often the lovers see her beautiful looks and stuff through her veil. So it's like this thing that's keeping her kind of innocent almost. But when she gets beaten up in 5:7, I think it's because it's clear now that she's not as innocent as she has appeared to be throughout the song. And so I think the veil kind of symbolizes that. I didn't put it in the sermon because, like, I'm not super sure, but that seems to be what it looks like to me. And no one's really sure, to be honest. I think that makes sense to me.
Next one is, what would you say the role of the individual have if they are struggling with sexual sin? For example, the lover can't even control it herself when Solomon calls. So how are we able to control ourselves in that area, or even is even possible to get it under control?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. It's kind of up to the individual, right? Like, so the warning of Song of Songs is, don't awaken love before it so desires. If you hear that warning and you obey it, listen to it before you've awakened sexual love, then I think you're making your life easier. Because although it can feel good, so Song of Songs is really clear, sexual love feels good, but it doesn't always lead to good things. So you want to awaken sexual love in environments where you can enjoy it without the consequences. And then kind of elsewhere in the Bible clarifies that. It's like within marriage. So if you're struggling with sexual desire or sexual sin, which is actually like every single person, right? Everyone struggles with it in different ways. So maybe you might be same-sex attracted. Maybe maybe it's pornography. Maybe it's adultery when you're in marriage. So even like when you're in marriage, there's no guarantee of sexual, of like keeping it all under control. Like there's a lot, like sexual sin is just so pervasive and deep in us that it makes it hard to control. So Song of Songs warning is like, don't even waken it, let it lie sleeping, because once you awaken it, it's a beast, it's uncontrollable. If you have awakened it, I think then you're in struggle. Like it's just very hard then to be fighting it constantly. And to be honest, we all fight it constantly in some way, because we've all awakened it in some way. Like I have, you have, we all have. The more we awaken it, the more we struggle to keep it under control. So Song of Songs says, don't awaken it. And if you do, you're just going to be fighting against it. It's kind of this force that keeps, it never quite goes away. It's a very hard sin to kill, I think. Mm-hmm. And meeting, like in Bible college, I've met a lot of people. I meet a lot of pastors, like the people that you think are like the kind of, not that this is true at all, but like the pinnacle of, you know, Christianity, right? You're at Bible college. And like every single person struggles with sexual desire. Like when they open up and when you talk about that stuff, every single one without exception. So it's just hard. Like once you awaken it, it's super hard. So if this is before you've awakened it, then just like really heed that warning. If it's after it, it's okay, but we just have to fight against it.
I guess maybe pray.
Yeah. Praying. And like, I guess within the context, like this is part of the reason why I started preaching on Song of Songs, because I don't have the answer for you. Like I can't tell. And I struggle with myself. But communally, if you find someone here that you trust and that you can talk about it with, maybe like you can share that load and you can think about how to control that desire until a time that you can express it. Maybe two or three people. Maybe you trust me and you want to ask me. I'd love to be able to talk to you about that. But maybe you trust someone else. Maybe it's your husband or wife that you should talk to.
Yep.
So I don't have the specific answer, but
I hope that by starting the conversation, we can talk about it properly and help. Yeah.
Okay. There's a few more questions to go, so let's move on to the next one. If God created humanity for sexual desire, how does pornography plays a role? Is it bad? Is it sin? Is it lust?
Yeah, so sexual desire is a good thing created by God. And I think we've proven as humans we can take good things and make them very bad. And that's just one way we've made sexual desire very bad is through pornography. Because I think it awakens a whole bunch of stuff that you can't really fulfill because I'll get onto this more next week. So next week, this is probably where I'll go. But sexual desire is there's a connection between God, Song of Songs tells us that there's a connection between God or theology and the act of sex. Like we don't think there is normally, right? It's like sex is sex, God is God. But Song of Songs blurs the two. It kind of bleeds them into each other. And what that means is that the things that God calls us to do in all of life, he calls us to do in sex as well, in sexual desire. So sexual desire then involves things like loving the other. It's not just for greed and self-pleasure, but it's actually for the pleasure of the other. And it's for encouraging the other. It's for all these sorts of things that we're called to do in other parts of our Christian life. So what pornography does, I think, specifically is make it all about personal pleasure and it removes the other from it. And I think that's one way that we can distort good sexual desire. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's sin, it's lust, it's a struggle.
Mm-hmm.
If you're struggling with pornography, like that's not the end of it. Like you're not condemned because of that, but it's just a struggle you're going to have to fight against.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Next one, what does the garden signify?
What does the garden signify? It in this chapter, actually, I think pretty consistently, the garden is like her bed of sexual desire. It's like it's her body, it's her sexuality, it's all those things that she keeps hidden off and should.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Solomon gets to experience it, he experiences the best of it. It's like now I've kind of enjoyed the choice fruits of her garden, you know, the flowing fountain, all that. Like you can read into that what you want.
Yep.
But it's like the garden's like her sexuality, her body included, all that sort of stuff.
Okay.
I got to watch this back on the recording.
I think this is just a comment. I just want to say I'm enjoying Steve's special expression during this Q&A. Okay.
That's a bonus.
Yep. Next one, and I think this is the last one. Do you think Solomon is in heaven or hell?
I don't know. I'm gonna say heaven. Like he did a lot of bad things, right? And the kingdom was eventually torn. Israel was eventually torn apart because of his actions.
Mm-hmm.
But his father David did a whole bunch of bad things as well. But God consistently called him a man after his heart. So I think, and this kind of does tie back into Song of Songs, like poor choices in the area of sexuality doesn't mean you're going to hell. You can make poor choices in the area of sexuality, but as long as you follow Jesus genuinely, yep. Which would include like trying to rein in those choices, you're going to heaven. And so Solomon could actually marry 1,000 women and could have been like the biggest adulterer in the world, but he could still be in heaven, I think. I think he is as well. Yeah, I reckon he is.
Yep.
That's just a guess. Like, it doesn't tell us, but my guess is like he's there. He followed God. He tried to follow God. At the end of his life, he failed quite badly. But it's like, it's not the final, like if you die in the process of a sin, it doesn't make you not a Christian. You're just a Christian who died in the process of sin.
Yep.
So I think he's in heaven.
Okay. No worries. Thank you, John, thank you for answering this question.
Good questions. I enjoyed
questions as well. But yeah, if you have more questions, feel free to put them down and John will look into it.